Good morning, all. Welcome to the program. This is the panel portion. We're starting a little bit late, but don't worry. We're going to make it up once we're in the air. And we'll be going right to 11 o'clock, and we do have lots to talk about, and we will do exactly that. Let me get to the introductory part of this, where we welcome our wonderful panelists, and then we'll be off to the races. We always welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is here. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Well, I feel morally obligated this morning to say something very briefly about Gaza, even though it's not on the docket. We're going to talk about other things appropriately. But on Wednesday, 54 Palestinians were reported killed at one of the northern crosses trying to access food. Thursday, 91 Palestinians killed, more than 600 wounded trying to access food at one of the points. And yesterday, in the last 24 hours, 33 people, including 12 children, died of malnutrition, starvation. And just as we've talked about before, something needs to be done. And also in Ukraine, which is not in the headlines, but the deadliest attacks this year in Ukraine overnight in Kyiv and all throughout the region where hundreds of people have been killed. So the president said he would stop these wars on the first day, and something needs to be done. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sorry to very, start it out
no,
that way, but
it,
I just
a, no. It's a very important.
Just,
it's a very important way, and it's and I do think we'll spend some time talking.
Yeah,
about
I know
it
we talked a lot about it. And we have other things, but a friend of mine who's in relief services sent me some data overnight, and it just is just stunning that the U.S., that the president is still backing the Israeli method of distributing food rather than shifting back to the humanitarian organizations who know how to do this and know how to do it safely. And it would save lives in many different ways. And we just have to keep reminding people of that.
Aaron Pacitti is professor of economics at Siena College. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. I mean, I'm doing as well as possible.
Yes, given what's going on. I will say that, you know, every once in a while, if you're, you know, you're in a subway and a woman's water breaks and all of a sudden you're like, quick, get a doctor. We need help. Well, yesterday during the show, about three times, we needed an economist. And we said, well, where's Aaron? Where's Aaron? And then I said, don't worry, Aaron will be here tomorrow. So you meeting today, mm-hmm. and you got a lot of work ahead of you. So we have tariffs, and we have the Fed, and we have all kinds of the markets, and just lots of stuff to talk about.
Yeah,
so
there's the unemployment report. There's the GDP report.
Rate.
I mean,
yeah. So we'll get to all that, and that's
the price of mangoes. It's about to go up.
We'll even get to that. Buy gum, and if you are going to buy gum, it's more expensive.
Not mango gum.
Mark Whitman is here, investment banker on Wall Street, our good friend. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. I'm happy to be here with Aaron. He always checks my work. And have I ever told you how much I respect Teresa? I really appreciate your comments at the outset. I know it's Friday, but I think some things just can't be ignored.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, that's a great, wonderful. We have a great group today, full of respect and for one another and the great work that they do. In a casual moment, I just want to say thanks to Mark for the donuts, because I didn't have breakfast this morning and I was starving and I didn't know when I was going to get to eat. And he brought donuts.
Can we also mention the beautiful flowers that Mark grows?
Yes.
He grows the most gorgeous flowers and brought them in for the staff today. And they're just artwork. So not only a brilliant, you know, business person, but a flower grower.
A kind soul.
A green thumb.
A green thumb.
I enjoy them. They're a lot of fun. And the highlight is to give them away and make people happy.
And what is the type of flower?
They're all dahlias out there.
Dahlias. They're artwork. They're gorgeous.
Very nice. Well, welcome all. It's nice to have you all here. And hopefully you can just picture us around a table with lots of flowers, lots of dahlias, lots of donuts. It's a pretty good, it's a swanky gig. It really is.
It's a great group.
So let us begin and talk about what is making news on this Friday morning, on this first day of the month of August. We'll start with tariffs. And we will talk about how the President of the United States last night signed executive orders setting updated tariff rates on more than 65 countries in the European Union. While the administration has said for weeks that today is the deadline to implement these tariffs, the new executive orders indicate many won't take effect for at least another week. Trump has repeatedly moved trade deadlines as he continues to negotiate with various countries. And this has been the big question as to what these tariffs would be and what the result would be. The U.S. job growth pulled back and markets are falling after Donald Trump announced these new tariffs. Global markets were rattled as investors grappled with signs of cracks in the U.S. economy and the implications of President Trump's escalating trade war. And as Aaron mentioned, there is the jobs report, which is breaking news that just came out just a bit ago, with employers slowing hiring in July, adding 73,000 jobs. So a lot there. I will let you sort of pull apart whatever you want to do with that, Aaron, to begin with, and then we'll go from there.
My brain hurts.
Yes,
from all of this, it's a lot. It's been,
is interrelated. I mean, that's the thing.
Well,
these stories converge, and they have an effect.
So, what I'm going to try to do, without giving a lecture and shutting Mark and Teresa out, who I encourage to interrupt me if I'm going on too long. Earlier this month, we got an inflation report that started to show some signs of rising inflation, particularly for imported goods that are subject to tariffs. We had a GDP report that showed signs of a slowing economy. We, as Joe pointed out, we had a jobs report that showed slowing job growth. We had the Federal Reserve meeting this past Wednesday, where they decided that because of all of the policy uncertainty that they were going to hold interest rates constant. And then, of course, there's the really big news, which is the August 1st tariffs are back announcement. So there's two things before we get into the details. There's two things that I want everybody to remember, and I'll try to come back to this at the end. In my opinion, in the opinion of a lot of other economists, there are Trump's trade policy is very likely to create stagflation in the U.S., which is the combination of stagnation and inflation. So we should expect to see, over the next 6 to 12 months, slowing growth, slowing job growth, higher unemployment, higher interest rates. That's the stagnating part. And then there's the inflation part, which is higher prices for consumer goods. So remember stagflation. And also remember that the major headline, or the most reliable estimate I've seen, comes from the Yale Budget Lab, which is that if these tariffs are implemented, it will cost the average U.S. household about $2,800 per year in extra expenses for buying the goods they need. So stagflation, $2,800 per household, meaning households will be $2,800 poorer. So the tariffs. Tariffs are a tax on imports, whether you're importing Canadian lumber, Taiwanese semiconductors, clothing from Bangladesh. A tariff is a tax on imports. So after the Liberation Day debacle, where markets crashed, Trump chickened out, backed off, said, all right, we're going to give everybody a 90-day reprieve and we're going to go negotiate 90 deals in 90 days, which obviously didn't happen. The tariffs are back on. Now, countries have a 1 week. So by next Friday, August 7th, countries that haven't negotiated a deal with the U.S. yet have the opportunity to do so. Otherwise, these new tariffs will go into effect. So some tariffs that were announced in April never went away. The tariffs on steel imports, aluminum imports, car parts, deals with China. So some tariffs never went away. Some are back. Some went away and are coming back. There are some new ones that have nothing to do with economics, like the tariffs on Brazil. So if this sounds confusing, it is. I can't keep track of what is happening, and that's why my brain hurts. So the new tariffs are going to range from anywhere from 10 to 41%, depending on the country and product. Interestingly, the three countries that seem to be subjected to the highest tariff rates, 40%, are Syria, Laos, and Myanmar. Now, I don't know why you would have exceptionally high tariffs on poor countries that the U.S. does very little international trade with, but such is the state of affairs in the Trump administration. Other countries, depending on whether they negotiate or depending on how Trump feels when he wakes up in the morning, will only have a flat 10% tariff unless something has been previously negotiated, like the EU, Japan, and South Korea did. So if this all sounds confusing to an individual, imagine how this feels to a giant multinational corporation like General Motors or large construction firms where they have, you know, dozens of supply chains for steel and lumber and electronics and glass and this and that. This, you know, scattershot trade policy of, well, the tariffs are on. Okay, now they're not, but some of them are going to be back on. And now they're off. And now they're going to be back on, but not until Friday. And some of them are going to be different than before. And countries still have the opportunity to negotiate. That, and the only word I can think to describe it is chaotic. It creates an enormous amount of uncertainty for large employers in the U.S. So a couple of weeks ago, General Motors reported, was it $1.1 billion in $1.1 billion in lower earnings. You're going to see other car manufacturers following suit. So in addition to the economic effects, which is creating enormous amount of uncertainty for businesses, enormous amount of higher financial costs for consumers, the U.S. is also souring relationships with a lot of our allies, and it's going, and Canada's already reorienting its international trade priorities, and it's, you know, moving the, center of economic power away from the U.S. The equivalent is like shooting yourself in the foot and declaring victory over your enemies. Nobody's quite sure what Trump's goal here is. Is it to restore manufacturing jobs? Well, perhaps. But if you want to restore manufacturing jobs, you can't just raise tariffs on goods that you import and expect that overnight the U.S. is going to start producing semiconductors and clothing and iPhones and laptops. Setting up those chip fab plants, setting up those apparel plants take years, sourcing raw materials. This is, it takes firms decades to get these, to get production up and running. So this begs other questions. Are these tariffs permanent? Will there be exemptions? Will firms be able to lobby and, get exemptions because of some critical part? It's also important to understand that even though, he came out with the, Mark and I were talking in the green room about the, one, the poor design of the Liberation Day poster, but also the incredibly high tariffs, that the fact that he's coming down from, 60% tariffs on, Bangladesh or whatever, even with these new tariffs, even if they're at a, even if they range in the 10 to 20% range, that is a tenfold increase relative to the average weighted tariff rate pre-Trump. Meaning U.S. consumers and U.S. businesses face tariffs of around 2% prior to this trade war. And now, if these tariffs go into effect, consumers will be facing 20% or higher average tariff rates. So it's going to be messy. And the trade deals that he has, quote, struck, and I'm using the air quotes, but both in terms of deals and struck, are largely meaningless, countries are, giving concessions to things they were going to do anyway. And I don't know how the government of Japan forces private Japanese firms to buy U.S. parts. Firms can buy goods for whatever they need from whatever country they want. What is the government of Japan going to mandate that Honda buys steel from the United States? Honda's just going to say, no, we can buy it from wherever we want. So these are largely unenforceable trade pacts that give the appearance of a victory and a trade deal without actually accomplishing anything.
Can I ask
Yes, you can ask a question.
Please.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Teresa will ask questions, and then we'll start to dig in a little bit more to this. It's our roundtable panel for this Friday, the 1st of August. We will continue right after this short break.
Support comes from Wilton Wildlife, working to connect visitors with nature, environmental education, and outdoor experiences for all ages in Saratoga County. More at wiltonwildlife.org. Berkshire Community College, celebrating 65 years with Community Fest on Saturday, August 16th, 10 to 4. Family and kids activities, educational opportunities, food trucks, and more. BerkshireCC.edu/CommunityFest. An Albany Institute of History and Art, presenting On the Road to Cragsmore with Charles Courtney Curran, featuring the American Impressionist painter, on view through October 13th. AlbanyInstitute.org.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Aaron Pasitti, Mark Whitman, and Teresa Bourgeois. Aaron has been giving us the lowdown on the tariffs and where we are as of this morning. Teresa buzzed in with a question. Yes.
Yeah, I would like to ask both Mark and Aaron about the U.S. auto industry in particular. So the Trump administration says that they want to strengthen manufacturing in the U.S., and one of the places that already exists is the auto industry. But it seems like a number of moves that have been made in the last couple of weeks have really are a real blow to the U.S. auto industry. First, changing direction on electric vehicles, but also on all of these tariffs. If you look at the tariffs in Japan, seem to give the Japanese auto industry an upper hand, if I'm reading that correctly. And then the uncertainty around what's going to happen with Canada, but raising tariffs on them and having it unclear what the trade agreements between U.S., Canada, and Mexico, because there's such an interrelationship between U.S., Mexico, and Canada around the auto industry. So can you talk specifically just about the auto industry? And it seems like they're being assaulted from every direction. And the range of tariffs on access to aluminum and steel and such, the component parts of cars.
Okay. So the U.S. auto industry, despite having an outsized presence, only makes up about 3% of total U.S. production. So it's not a major part of the U.S. economy.
But aren't the parts suppliers and the
sure.
and
well,
the
right.
dealerships all around the country, and aren't there lots of jobs?
There's the downstream effects.
Downstream of jobs, It's a lot of small business involved in making autos.
So,
and
you know, one of
them.
The tariffs that didn't disappear after April was the tax on or the tariff on imported car parts. The whole idea that, you know, when you hear people talk about buy American, I mean, that's just a fallacy. That's something that hasn't happened since the 1970s. U.S. made cars, or let me rephrase that. Firms made cars made by U.S. auto firms, General Motors, Ford, Cadillac, whomever. You know, it's about 50% or more of the parts that are used to make those cars are imported.
They're multinational, just like the U.S.
Exactly.
population.
Just like the construction industry and just like every other industry in many. The flip side of that coin is that foreign automakers like Honda and Volkswagen have plants in the U.S. that employ U.S. workers. So, you know, the idea that, you know, buying American and raising prices on imported goods is going to, you know, save U.S. businesses and help manufacturing workers is not only it's just not true. It's going to be exceptionally damaging to the people that Trump is purportedly trying to help, which is manufacturing workers. So if the price of steel and the price of car parts and the price of computer chips that go into cars goes up, you're already seeing car makers saying, we're anticipating billions of dollars of losses in the future.
Right.
That's going to lead to layoffs of auto workers. And then there's the downstream effects. Well, what happens to dealerships? What happens to all of the vendors that are part of this incredibly complicated supply chain? And then you have the people that are even outside of that world where, you know, restaurants outside of, you know, Ford's Dearborn plant or whatever mm-hmm. are going to start shuttering because workers aren't going out to eat. So, yeah, like I said, we're shooting ourselves in the foot and declaring victory against an enemy that doesn't exist. And we're claiming that this is successful.
It just seems that the deals that were made with other countries are more beneficial to them than the U.S. auto market. Certainly with Japan. The other thing is, are these deals, has there been, you know, he said 90 deals in 90 days, which I haven't come close to that. But are there any that are actually final signed deals? Or aren't these primarily frameworks of agreements?
Yeah, my understanding is they're memos of understanding. And it's historically taken years to get from that stage to final agreements. And frankly, even when you get to a final agreement in trade, it's one thing to read the rules. It's another thing to see how it's actually implemented. A great example now is China starting to detain Western executives and not letting them leave the country. So you can open up the banking rules in China, but if Wells Fargo won't let anyone travel from the West to do business in China, it doesn't really matter what your final agreement reads. So there's a lot of leisure domain here. Anyone with, I think, a modicum of intelligence sees that when Trump declares that he, quote unquote, has a deal, he's falling far short of anything that's complete or assures us that in practice his advertised objectives are being fulfilled.
And the other thing, Mark, the deals seem to be tariffs plus required investments, as you spoke to, Aaron. And that part of it, I don't really understand. First of all, if he says we want to keep everything American, then why does he want these non-U.S. companies to be, you know, buying up companies or, you know, start running, you know, owning companies, owning land, owning whatever in the United States? Isn't that counter to what he says he believes in? And second of all, how firm or real are these quote-unquote agreements about U.S. investments?
We know they're not real because he had a deal at the end. Trump had a deal at the end of his last administration with China, where China was supposed to buy a certain amount of American product as part of the agreement. And China fell woefully short, and no one's held him to account. Trump certainly hasn't emphasized that last great deal he cut was a mirage, but it was. And so I think Aaron pointed out, even in the EU, they've got as part of this memo of understanding that was currently announced, they've got a required investment in the United States in productive capabilities, which should benefit us in terms of employment in the United States and investment. But the EU has no power to run around to private companies and say, you must invest in the United States and make sure that in aggregate they're fulfilling Trump's illusory targets.
And I read that part of the EU agreement is that they buy, you know, fossil fuels from the U.S., right? Oh. And without there's not capacity to meet the demand that they say that they're going to do that, a mechanism.
And what infrastructure exists to get liquefied natural gas from the U.S. to Europe?
That's what they said.
I mean, you need a transatlantic pipeline that doesn't exist. Oil's sold on a global market, so it's not like, you know, France talks to Shell and says, all right, please send us 10 million barrels of oil. The way the oil market works is that, you know, all of the oil that's produced worldwide gets pooled in these different refining facilities worldwide, and, you know, firms just buy the output of that. So what's American? What's from Saudi Arabia? What's from Iran? What's from Venezuela? All of that gets mixed together. On paper, this looks good. And on paper, Trump can claim a victory for the U.S. because people will see that and say, ah, yeah, they're going to buy more of our stuff. In no way is this enforceable. And to the extent that there's any foreign investment that happens, this was probably foreign investment that was planned 2 or 3 years ago.
Here's what I've learned in the last 30 minutes. We need more time to talk about this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to a slightly abbreviated version, although we are, as I said, making up some time. So we'll be going until 11 o'clock this morning. We started at 9:30 and spent some quality time with our friends from North Country Public Radio before that. This morning, let me reintroduce our group. Teresa Bourgeois is here. Aaron Pacitti and Mark Whitman. We are talking about tariffs and overall economic concerns. We have had a pretty complete report, at least on tariffs, from Professor Pacitti. We have some excellent questioning and concerns that were posed and voiced by Teresa Bourgeois. And now we go to Mark Whitman.
Joe, I've tried to come up with a unifying theory around all this noise. And I with the help of The Economist, which wrote an article months back about Trump for Dummies, and then a good friend of mine who I mentioned before, and I cite both of them out of intellectual honesty, the inflation guy, I've come up with something. If you're Trump, here's the playbook. And I think we've all seen this, whether it be on immigration, frankly, the Houthis or tariffs. Number one, you identify a real-world problem. You start with a genuine problem, but in Trump's case, it becomes a grievance. And then number two, you exaggerate the problem. You use hyperbole and emotionally charged language. They're taking our jobs. They're ripping us off. Three is you propose bold but vague solutions. So when Trump has his Liberation Day, for instance, or he describes how many of the irregular immigrants that he's going to expel from the country, you have these solutions that just are extreme, but they're operationally flexible. You don't define exactly what the goals are. Then you can count on your opponents, who, if you're Trump, they hate you so badly, and they've struggled for so long to sort of withhold from initial emotional responses. You wait till your opponents respond with often emotional counterarguments, and then your opponents will necessarily get into technical and nuanced legalisms and explanations. But if you're Trump, that's what you want, because you immediately counter with simple language and you go back to your emotional appeals. And by the way, you may have exaggerated about the size of the U.S. trade problem, but in reality, you started with something that's true. We all know that there were imbalances between trade practices, whether it be tariffs or the actual application of rules around free trade. So if you're Trump, when your opponents go mad, you're actually in a great spot because you can seem like the reasonable one. And in the case of tariffs, we actually saw the markets go mad. As I've talked about many times on this panel, the stock market reacts in the short run based on emotions and expectations. And it did that to Trump's Liberation Day trade. Now, arguably, in the stock market's defense, it sort of righted the ship in terms of those reactions. And it came up with the taco trade, realizing that this is the Trump strategy. And he always does start with extremes and then work back. You've also got incredible tailwinds in the economy. At least in the global economy, and some nuance around the support that countries have given that governments have given countries when they run into trouble, that offer the explanation. When Trump's proponents keep saying, well, it can't be as bad as everybody's saying, they keep saying, well, look at the stock market. The answer is there's so many tailwinds in this economy that it's not surprising the stock market is where it is, even though Trump's tariffs are a really bad idea. But then when you're Trump, once your opponents have these emotional, technical responses, you scatter breadcrumbs of moderation and you navigate between the extremes, extremes that even you've created with your own base. So when Peter Navarro wants to keep going, you say, no, we're not going to go that far. You actually, if you're Trump, you say sometimes I didn't even propose those extreme things you're talking about. And so all of a sudden, you're the moderate one in the room. And even Trump, as soon as there's any improvement, so he's got a deal with the EU. We can talk about whether or not that's a good or a bad deal. I think if you look even within Europe, there's probably criticism about equal against Europeans and whether or not that was a good or a bad deal, if you will. And by the way, it's only a memo of understanding. It's a rough outline. It's nothing like a finished product. But what you do if you're Trump is as quickly as you can, frankly, even if you're not responsible, you declare victory and say, I've won. The The problem is, as Aaron talked about, is most of these solutions, if you look about immigration, the Houthis, or now where we are with tariffs, most of these immigrations are fall woefully short of a real solution. But if you're Trump, that's okay because you never promised anything specific. You just had an emotional response, and now you can dampen your emotional response and start to declare some victory. And frankly, I would like to say, Aaron's, in the case of tariffs, I actually agree with the directional appraisal of what Aaron said, but I don't think it's as dire as many people say. And this is where I quote others, including the inflation guy. A 15 to 20% tariff in the United States against all, basically all the goods that we're talking about thus far would lead to an increase in inflation of about 0.5 to 0.7% sort of spread over a year to 18 months. It's painful. If you look at the cumulative effect, it could be trillions of dollars, it should be three-ish trillions of dollars over 10 years, maybe $2.5-3 trillion. So it hurts. But it's not something that immediately sends us into the inflation levels that we saw, say, last year. And the GDP impact is probably about 0.9% of growth over that same period, or about $160 billion annually. So again, it's not a good thing. It costs American consumers. But because of the technicalities around, and this gets back to the Trump for Dummies, because of the technicalities of how tariffs get actually filtered down to the consumers in the United States, you know, on a roughly $16 bottle of olive oil, this 15% tariff equates to, I think it's about 50 cents or something. So it hurts, but it's not nearly as bad as the markets first said it was, as Trump's critics first said it was. I mean, we'll get through it. Whether or not it's a good thing for the U.S. or not is a whole other discussion. The other thing that Trump does when he solves these problems, he is necessarily preying on assets like our standing in the world, the predominance of the dollar, our alliances with others. He basically serves to undermine or deteriorate those, or in a way spend those to get what he wants in terms of a final result. And that cost is hard to take out a calculator and figure out what the net effect is. So it allows him to still declare victory. And if you take a couple bolts out of the 747, it still flies. So what Trump is doing is selling bolts while we're in the air. At some point, we actually may crash, but it explains why we're still at altitude in terms of the market, even though what we're doing is undermining in many ways many of the assets the United States had. So I think if you look at sort of the Trump for Dummies model, you can apply that to what he did with the Houthis, where, by the way, they're still sinking ships, even though he declared victory over there. You can look at that with what he's doing with immigration, and you can certainly look at that where we are in the midst of tariffs. I will say, I think this will hurt the United States, but I don't think it's nearly as bad as the initial emotional reaction that many people had to it would suggest it would be.
Okay, this is totally your area of expertise, so these are in the form of a question, not a statement. Your economic analysis, it sounds to me like you're saying it won't be as much of a budgetary impact as people anticipate. However, that presumes that this is the only thing he's done. But I think the tariffs have to be looked at in the context of a whole lot of other things that are happening. So thinking about the ag market and this impact on the ag market, if you look at the cuts to USAID and the cuts to the food programs, so the farmers are being hurt by the tariffs because it's disrupting their markets. But that is one part of a whole lot of other inputs that they are having to absorb because of these, because the USAID was a big part of their market. Cutting food stamps is going to affect them. So this is one component part of a much larger attack on the ag business. And so then food prices go up and that hurts people. Separately, what about the range of attacks that you see on small businesses who have a much less capacity to absorb these than the large oil industries and others? And then when you have, you know, the notion that you're going to you think about the rescission package and what's in that, and you think about the budget resolution, you know, the budget bill, right, and the range of cuts in that, and taken together, as well as the sort of deportation campaign, right? So you are pulling people out of the food processing, you're pulling people, workers out of the ag industry, again, across the board, hospitality industry. This is all part of a wider economic disruption, and you add in uncertainty, and doesn't that make the costs go up even more? And
yep.
I listened to Gene Sperling talk yesterday about stagflation, which, Aaron, you talked about, and it's the impact on consumers is going to be not you know, pittance or pennies.
Look, I there a lot, you said a lot there, a lot of it's true, some of it I take issue with. There are three things. Number one, Trump's a hack. The way he's doing this, no, but the way he gets to the final result.
Well, I want to get to that in a minute, but
the way he gets to the final result costs a lot because he creates a tremendous amount of uncertainty and disruption that's unnecessary. That's why presidents in the past and administrations in the past didn't do it this way. It wasn't because George Bush, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama are all stupid. It's because they understood more of the interrelationship of these issues. So when they wanted to improve the U.S. trading position, they did so quietly over years of negotiations. Trump does it, and he creates a lot of costs associated with it. So you're certainly right about that. And you're right about the interrelationship. One of the reasons that was cited by Europeans as to why they should agree to the 15% was because it was the easiest way to keep Trump and the United States politically and militarily engaged in Europe with respect to Ukraine
and other
efforts. Right. And there was a number of them, but that was one. So in a way, Trump's visibly trading economic costs. He's in a way monetizing some of our support for Europe. And I would argue that's not a horrible, even though Donald Trump did it, I'm not a fan. I would argue that's not a horrible trade, and we should have done that long ago. On the third, the one thing I do want to comment on, this issue, you also, a lot of times you'll hear when there are economic policies that have downstream effects. So let's agree that USAID in aggregate was a good thing. We shouldn't have abandoned it. Okay. I agree. But in the hypothetical case, don't start writing me letters, but in the hypothetical case that we all decide around this table, USAID is a bad idea. but USAID is a bad idea, okay? Let's just say we all decide USA was a bad idea, and then someone runs into the room and says, oh, but you're going to hurt farmers downstream. The farmers downstream is an extraneous argument. If USA, and I'll tell you the flip side of that argument, hold on, the flip side of that argument is Trump wants to protect copper jobs in the United States, or the copper industry in the United States. It's a bad idea. We shouldn't do it. And I can prove that because in the past when we put quotas and restrictions on copper in the United States, the downstream effects in the United States were so expensive that it would have been easier to write a check to the people who were employed by the copper industry and send them home on the couch than to actually have the cost of that run through the economy. So the downstream of, if you decide that spending money on something's a bad idea, the fact that there's a downstream effect is the wrong, that's the tail
what
literally wagging
the dog. What I'm saying is you can't ignore that there is a downstream effect.
No, you need to ignore the downstream. I'm saying you need to ignore the downstream effects.
Well, not the farmers can't ignore that there's the downstream effect.
Yeah, it's
going to impact what it's impacting their business, so they have to shift to new markets.
Welcome to One at a Time Theater.
I'm sorry.
You know,
go ahead. One at a time.
Agriculture is like 1% of U.S. employment. I mean, it's a relatively minor sector.
But food prices impact everybody.
Sure. And a lot of food's imported. Most fresh fruits and vegetables are imported.
Mangoes.
Food prices are affected by weather. They're affected by diseases. So it's not just the tariffs that affect food prices.
Oh, I know. But there's a whole lot of things going on now that are going to affect food prices.
So,
climate change.
Right. Yeah, right. Weather. Mark did a great job explaining the Trump playbook. I thought that was actually very helpful because it seems chaotic, but there is a method.
It's the same playbook.
Right, I know.
It's a sort of a shortened version if you look at the Houthis, and a longer version if you look at tariffs. But I think it allows you to take a deep breath and sort of when you see where we are in the stages, and some of them mesh in and are iterative. I think you can take a deep breath and sort of let it all play out with a lot less emotion, which is something I think his opponents have politically failed to do.
And that's why it's so successful. Right, yeah. So as an economist, you know, there's the bluster and the policy responses and all of that. To me, the effects of this is going to be, will be an empirical question. Meaning, so you look at data and you assess how policy, whether it's tariff policy, whether it's foreign policy, whether it's how aggressive ICE is in deporting people, whether it's the budgetary impact of his tax cut bill. So in the past 2 weeks, we've gotten three major economic news releases. And I want to state a very important caveat. Never read too much into one single month of a data report. They're volatile. Sometimes they go up. Sometimes there's aberrations that right themselves over time. But that's what we have to look at. So the jobs report that came out this morning showed the economy only added 73,000 jobs in June, which was about 25% less than the 104,000 forecast. That's not the big story. The big story is that when the Bureau of Labor Statistics calculates the unemployment rate and the number of jobs added, they send surveys to businesses. It's called the Establishment Survey. And businesses respond to that saying, you know, how many workers do you have on payroll? How many jobs did were created? How many people did you lay off? And the Bureau of Labor Statistics pulls that information to come up with an estimate of national job creation. Some firms respond very quickly. Some firms, it takes 2 or 3 months before they get their survey responses in. So every month, the Bureau of Labor Statistics revises its statistics based on more complete information. So the big story that came out this morning was the Bureau of Labor Statistics revised down the number of jobs created over the past 2 months by 258,000. So over the last 2 months, when it appeared the U.S. economy was adding about 150,000 jobs a month, we only added, in total, 14,000 jobs. So what we're seeing is at least the beginnings of a pattern in a slowdown in job creation. The Trump economy. That doesn't mean firms are laying off workers and that the unemployment rate's skyrocketing, that we're heading towards a recession. But what we're seeing is the beginning of a slowdown in hiring. It's been pretty broad-based. It's not just government employees. It's leisure and hospitality. It's manufacturing. It's a whole lot of industries. So that's one data point, is slowing job growth. That's the first part of stagflation. The second part of stagflation was the GDP report that came out earlier this week. It showed a surprising increase after a surprising decrease in the first quarter. Both of those numbers are skewed. The reason why GDP contracted in the first quarter of 2025 was because firms were trying to get ahead of the tariffs and import as many raw materials as they could, which depressed GDP growth. As that slowed down and they built up inventories, that added to a surprisingly large impact, positive impact on GDP in the second quarter. But the real story about gross domestic product, which is the broadest measure of economic growth economists have, is underneath the surface. And what economists look at is what's called final demand, which looks at essentially domestic consumer spending and domestic business spending, which they call investment. And it includes government spending, too. But what you see is that consumer spending, which makes up 70% of all economic activity, fell from 2.8% in 2024 down to 1.4% over the past 6 months. So consumer spending is still growing, but it's growing at a slower rate, just like job creation. Business spending, 8% increase in quarter one, 1.4% increase in quarter two. So yes, consumer and business spending are still growing, but they are growing at slower rates. So again, we're not sleepwalking because we know this is happening. We are marching towards stagflation. And the last part of that was the inflation report that came out in the middle of June. And what it showed was the largest one-month increase in prices economy-wide since August of 2021. Is inflation spiraling out of control? No, It went up on a year-over-year basis from 2.4 to 2.7%. So what we're seeing is the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg. And you don't want to read too much into this because that could be an anomaly. Whether it's with job growth, whether it's with gross domestic product, whether it's inflation. But again, the takeaway of inflation is beneath the surface. Most of the price increases that happened were in goods that are imported. Apparel, household furnishing, appliances, toys, paper products, and aluminum. You're seeing Coke and soft drink and all types of drink manufacturers saying we're going to have to raise costs because bottling costs are going to go up.
Right? Pharmaceutical companies.
From the aluminum tariffs. So that's part of the story. Why didn't inflation go up more? Well, because you have softening demand for energy. So that's being offset by declining prices in energy. As Mark pointed out, it's very complicated to say X is going to lead to Y. There is a whole chain of events in a $30 trillion economy with 160 million workers and I don't know how many industries there are. I don't know, say 200 industries or whatever. This is going to take time to play out. And these are just the initial data reports that have come out this past month. So it's something to keep an eye on. And I will be boring people to death with these updates every month. I can see Joe half asleep over here.
No, hardly.
It's important that this is we're starting to see some of the preliminary effects. If they keep up, then we can start making more concrete conclusions.
45 seconds. Go ahead, Mark.
The way I'd say this in 45 seconds is if you look at where the stock market is and you want to counter Trump's opponents, the issue is that governments have been supporting the economy when it falters. We have incredible gains from international supply chains that have worked incredibly well, and interest rates have been very low. And as these things change, basically the Teflon economy is going to lose a lot of its protection when governments can't step in or when it's expensive because of interest rates or Trump deteriorates international supply chains.
Good morning. Welcome back to our panel discussion for this Friday morning. Teresa Bourgeois, Aaron Vicity, and Mark Whitman. We have about 26 minutes left, and we welcome you. We haven't gotten to any letters yet, but I promise to make good on that in the next few moments. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. But first, let's go to Teresa's questions.
So while you're lining up the letters, I have Aaron, well, for both of you, is for what does stagflation mean for the average kitchen table at the kitchen table or in a small business, you know, a bakery or a whatever? What does stagflation mean in the lives of small business people and the lives of people at their kitchen table?
That's a good question. And as a academic macroeconomist, it's easy for me to lose sight of the
because I don't think people know
everyday
that word
issues
so much.
For the, you know, just the data revision issues. It will mean slowing wage growth, so your raises won't be as large. You'll probably see slowing job growth. So if you do lose your job, it's going to be more difficult to get a new one. You're going to be paying higher interest rates on your credit card, on auto loans, on mortgage rates. So borrowing is going to become more expensive. So, you know, more financial uncertainty surrounding your ability to earn an income. That's the stagnation part. The inflation part is, well, if inflation does go up, the stuff that you buy on a daily basis is going to become more expensive. So you're going to have to just dedicate more of your income to buying that. If you're already stretched to the max, you're either going to go into debt or you're going to reallocate your budget so that it's like, okay, well, we're not taking a vacation this year because we need to buy groceries and prescriptions. For businesses, it'll mean slower sales. Businesses, if they try to pass on the full cost of the tariffs to consumers, though consumers might go somewhere else or they just might forgo purchasing that product altogether. So it means more financial insecurity and the vice around you in terms of price pressures and the cost of borrowing is going to be tightened considerably. More anxiety, more stress. It's going to affect lower and middle income households and smaller and medium sized businesses way more than it will affect the richest, 10% of the population.
letters?
Oh, we got letters.
Really? Right,
thank you. Go.
Let's see. Why isn't Aaron Pacitti working for the New York Times or CNN? He is so much more informative than anyone they have. Great panel today. Because we have him under exclusive contract where he works very hard and gets paid nothing.
Stagflation.
Thank you to whoever said that.
Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Dan says, thanks to the panel for the thorough tariff discussion, but one thing seems to always go unsaid, the grift. I would disagree that Trump is a hack. The market disruption is by design. Every time he announces new tariffs and then scales them back days later, he and his inner circle are making hundreds of millions of dollars by playing the market disruption. Obama, Bush, or others didn't do this because they were honest. And that is from Dan. Then we go to,
While you're looking for that, there was on the grift question, there were also people commenting yesterday about these deals he's doing about investments in the U.S. and how are those going to be made and what is the grift that may result of those that needs to be given careful attention because that's a source of real possible oligarchy issues.
I like this question. What is the historical accuracy of economists' predictions, both short-term and long-term? That will help put a lot of what is being said here in context.
Economists have predicted 10 of the last 5 recessions. If you notice, but neither Mark nor I ever used the word recession in our discussion. You can talk about slowing growth. You can talk about how this is going to play out. It's extraordinarily difficult to predict turning points in an economy. When an economy goes from growth to, you know, recession. So it's very difficult to do. Occasionally you see some, you know, Wall Street firms bet correctly, but a lot of them don't. So as I said before, the way to assess this is not to make bold predictions where there's no consequences if you're wrong. It's to have a much more sober look at the monthly data reports, put them in context of what's happening, and just start accumulating that evidence to figure out what's going to be happening 6 to 12 months from now.
But isn't that...
It's boring. It's not the answer I'm sure the letter writer wanted to hear, but that's how I go about looking at these things.
And I think about the business council, Heather Mulligan, talking about the key here is certainty, uncertainty. And I think the word for today definitely is uncertainty. This just adds a lot of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And I also think that there's not a lot of discussion given to the impact on these other countries as you weaken, you know, in an effort, his effort to strengthen the U.S. economy, is he weakening other economies, weakening the Mexican economy, weakening Bangladesh or some of these other countries. And then what happens, what's the impact on immigration if you do that and movement of people and so on and so forth, as well as not dealing with the climate change issue and a whole of other imports, but I'm disrupting
the letter, flip side
sorry.
Of that is he unintentionally strengthening countries like China? Because if the EU and Canada and other world economies say the U.S. is no longer a reliable trading partner,
correct.
This joker's changing policies via Truth Social posts. When you think about, you know, China 1.0, that was them using low-cost labor to make cheap manufactured goods. China 2.0 is a very different China. They're, you know, while we're cutting funding for research and development, they're pouring money into electric vehicle production, semiconductor production,
all in
AI.
On climate change.
China is already eclipsing where the U.S. is in many of these 21st century manufacturing fields. So well, is Trump weakening certain economies that used to be reliable trading partners? Yes. Is he also unintentionally strengthening those that he thinks are our biggest enemies? Yeah, absolutely.
And disrupting partnerships so that other countries will find other places to get their goods because
China.
The U.S. is not a good partner. Letters, sorry.
Jim says, Mark is so reasonable. He has done a great job of explaining the Trump play. The con is always afoot. Then we go to a similar letter from Theodore, who says Mark just nailed the Trump argument style. Polly says it is increasingly obvious that Trump has no idea how our economy works, nor how any other country's economy works. He thinks that his intuition is far superior to any facts. He is driven by retribution, and he's destroying our country in the process. That from Polly. And let's see, we go to Paul, who says, thanks to the panel for exposing the truth about the voodoo economic policies being implemented. What will the consequences be if the Supreme Court ultimately rules that most of the arbitrary tariffs are illegal and or constitutional?
Yeah, we were talking about this at the break, that yesterday there was an appeals court argument before an appeals court, and the court seemed disposed to dismiss the administration's argument that what it's doing falls under certain laws and case law that came out of those laws. I think that was in 1977. Yesterday, one of the investment houses, and I forget which, came out with an article saying that they don't think the Supreme Court will let a lot of this stand as well. I think part of the muted market reaction you're seeing today to the announcement is that the markets learned not to overreact from the last time it did overreact. But also, I think there's a suspicion that a lot of these tariffs may have a finite life to them, because there's a reasonable chance that the Supreme Court will decide against the administration. And Trump, if you listen to the news, Trump undermines his own argument that this is for the this is because of a crisis that faces the United States, when he does things like try to play emperor of Brazil and tell their Supreme Court that they can't enforce the laws in Brazil the way they see fit, because he has a different view and he's going to use tariffs in order to try and coerce them into acting against the way they see their own self-interest. And he's also, you know, he's done that with the Thailand and Cambodia and their dispute as well. So there's a strong argument that many of these measures will turn out to be temporary.
Yeah, the whole justification for the tariffs is the Economic Emergency Powers Act, which is that a president can bypass Congress if there is an economic emergency. So it could be something like an oil embargo, for example, or, the U.S. enters World War III and we need to, you know, turn General Motors into a drone production facility or something. It's meant for extreme circumstances like that, not because the U.S. is running a 3.1% of GDP trade deficit.
And as the court mentioned yesterday, that act does not even explicitly mention tariffs as being within the purview of the president. And so that was a pretty interesting questioning when the judges said, well, it doesn't even say you're allowed to mess with tariffs. In the law, the word doesn't appear. What are you doing? And the administration, of course, had to argue that you have to infer or impute it. Mm-hmm. But the administration does that a lot.
And I just think it's worth noting that this is grounded in the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8 says that, and I quote, among the Congress-specific powers, quote, to regulate commerce with foreign nations, and the power to, quote, lay and collect taxes, duties, and imposts and excises. So the Constitution gives Congress the power to do this. And as with so many other things that he's doing, like using executive orders rather than do the real work of working with the Congress and going through a process and negotiating these tariffs and then coming to some firm agreement on what they are, he's skipping all these process matters.
Well, so is Congress. Mike Johnson's made it very clear that just go ahead. You can. We'll cede you power to do whatever you want.
I think it's important, though, to constantly remember that this is outside the regular order, that this is not. I know I'm a policy wonk and this is a process thing, but this is not how the Constitution was set up to do this, and for a reason. There's a whole methodical process, both with Congress and even within the administration, in terms of how the details are negotiated and how these are worked out, so you don't have these jarring disruptions.
Right. We'll take a break and finish up on the other side. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this.
Support comes from Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, presenting a writing retreat with Cheryl Strayed, author of Wild, August 10th through 12th in Rhinebeck. More at eomega.org. And Amtrak, New York summer getaways from small-town highlights to big city lights across New York State, at Seat Power Outlets, daily schedules, and no middle seats. Amtrak.com to book. Support comes from WAMC Underwriters, a group of dedicated local businesses and organizations that provide financial support for WAMC programming, sponsorship opportunities at WAMCunderwriting.org, and the Hudson River Valley Greenway, offering trails and outdoor recreation to residents and visitors alike. HudsonGreenway.ny.gov/trails to find a trail to explore.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion. About 10 minutes left. The White House sends Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee to inspect food distribution sites and report back to the president immediately. Those top Trump officials visiting Gaza as the hunger crisis there draws outrage and deepens. Senior U.S. officials visited war-ravaged Gaza on Friday on a mission, the White House said, to inspect food distribution sites and develop a plan to ensure more aid gets to civilians amid growing international anger over mass starvation there. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee arrived in the Palestinian enclave, outfitted in protective vests and accompanied by aides and security. According to imagery shared on social media, Huckabee wore a military-style helmet, Witkoff a jet black ball cap bearing President Donald Trump's campaign slogan, "Make America Great Again."
God, why would he do that?
The the 100 million meals delivered so far amount to less than one meal per day per person in Gaza, and many of the products must be cooked and therefore require fuel and water, which are not readily available. In Steve Witkoff's statement, he said that he is there to learn about the truth. And Huckabee posted on X, said that the U.S. Israeli-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is giving them briefings, and they're getting briefings from the IDF and spoke to folks on the ground, and they are delivering these million meals, which is an incredible feat, says Huckabee. The escalating scenes of starvation in Gaza have deepened a global backlash against Israel, which has tightly controlled the amount of assistance distributed by the United Nations and other aid organizations during its ongoing war with Hamas. And so this is just, we touched on this, Teresa brought this up at the very beginning of her remarks this morning. Meanwhile, it should be said that yesterday, coming from here in New York, Governor Kathy Hochul says starvation of children in Gaza is unconscionable, which you would think would be a relatively easy statement to make, and yet took a while to actually make it.
Can I suggest that New York Times has a chart. If you want to know what's going on, it's very visible. In May, the Israelis blocked food from going into Gaza. And you can see month after month the implications for not allowing humanitarian aid, food and medicine to go into Gaza. And so it accelerated. I mean, before it was going in at much too slow a pace, but they blocked food. And then when they did start allowing food in, they did not allow the humanitarian organizations who know how to do this. They sent it through Israelis and this U.S.-based group that opened only four sites and managed in a way that ended up people being shot to try to get food. And that is not working. The answer to this is open the gates. Let the trucks that are lined up at the key entry points go in with protection and do what they know how to do. Let the humanitarian organizations who do this do what they do to stop people from starving.
Mark?
I look, Hochul may be late to the party, but I think all of us need to continue to put pressure on Trump. I think, again, I think we should spend our time as a country. There are other things that we're spending time on that we ought to focus Trump's attention on this, and we ought to tell him if you want to show that you care about kids and you want us to give us a break on another element of that, if you do this for us, we at least as the Democrats will step away from that other one and let you all sort that out on your side of the party. Two things. Number one, I don't know where you got the text that said there's a backlash against Israel. I do think that that type of language is a problem.
Right.
There's a backlash against the actions of the Israeli administration. And we as Americans, particularly those of us on the left, understand what that distinction means, country versus administration's actions. And I also think it's dangerous when you let that be the diagnosis, because then anyone who piles on to the issue becomes against the Israelis, which we're not, right? I mean, you can be a Zionist and believe that you need to stop this humanitarian crisis. The crisis here, the children that you see, the pictures, I've made this point before, that's just the tip of the iceberg. When you malnourish a young person early in their lives, you impair many, if not most of them, for the duration of that life. So there's a tremendous amount of loss that's already taking place that you're not seeing. The other thing I want to comment is sending Huckabee and Witkoff is just brilliant, because it shows what Trump does with the Republican side. He's for Putin. He's against Putin. He's for deporting everyone. He's against deporting farm workers and hotel workers. He's for Netanyahu. He's against Netanyahu. Until he has to be somewhere, he's nowhere. And the Republicans, who ignore the fact that this man lies as often as he tells the truth, all of them get to stand and say, well, Trump really believes what I believe. That little sentence of sending those two guys to this crisis point shows you again another sort of another part of the brilliance of Trump's strategy and why he's been so successful amongst Republicans.
But why is that brilliant? I'm interrupting Aaron.
It's nefarious but brilliant.
I mean, when Trump talked about this, the first thing when the reporters finally started pressing him on it last Saturday, right? First thing he said was, well, I sent $60 million and they didn't thank me. That was his first reaction. And then his second reaction is, well, they're just stealing the food. And then his reaction, well, was, you know, well, food's getting in and it's not as bad. But then I guess somebody showed him some pictures and now he's saying, well, it does look bad. And so I'm sending in food, but I'm giving it to the Israelis to distribute, right? That's not the solution. But I do agree with you, Mark, in praising Governor Hochul and anyone who speaks up now. And also, I thought there was a very important story. I heard it on NPR today, and I saw it in other coverage, that a whole group of Israeli leadership, particularly clergy in the United States, have very, you know, some key leaders have sent a letter and saying that they oppose what's going on there and that it doesn't reflect the core moral values of Israelis, which I think is, you know, true. And I agree with you, Mark. You do have to make, we all have to make the distinction that you can be against the Netanyahu actions that does not make you against the Israelis or being anti-Semitic. But the problem here is there's aid that's there. It's lined up outside the gates. Let them in and let the humanitarian community, rescue community, do what they do. When Trump says he's giving money to the Israelis to do this, reporters have to say, but that hasn't worked. That's ended up with way too many people, including children, being shot to death trying to access food. Sorry, Aaron.
Aaron, is there anything you want to?
No.
Okay. All right. We welcome you, panel. If we didn't get to a lot of the letters, but if you want to send them to us, we'd love to see them. We'll distribute them to the group, and it's panel at wamc.org. My thanks to everybody for making the effort this morning, and thank you all for changing your schedule so we could change our schedule. I hope you all have a beautiful weekend. Thank you for your thoughtfulness and making a lot of this stuff at least somewhat understandable. Somewhat.
Making WAMC great again.
Yes.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Thank you. We'll work on the
I'm
hats.
I'm joking. Yes, that was in
hats.
Such bad taste.
Thank you for being a great host,
Joe. Thank you very much, Teresa. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have another full hour of fun and frivolity here on the program, and we will be back to do that right after this.